My name is Michelle Vidovich. It is May 21st, 2018. I'm at the Public Library in Hudson, New York, and I'm recording life stories of Hudson residents as part of the Oral History Summer School. I'm here with Lori Scott, resident of Hudson. Lori, can you introduce yourself, please?
My name is Lori Scott. I actually am not a resident of Hudson. I actually am employed here as the director of Reentry Columbia, a small nonprofit that was organized about 5 years ago to meet the needs of people leaving incarceration.
Can you tell me about places that feel like home to you?
Interestingly, I grew up right on the Sawmill River in Yonkers. In an area on a hill above a swampy area that had been filled in with housing. But across the street was a meadow and the river, which we played in nonstop for many years. So places around rivers always feel at home to me. I love the water, love the sound of it, love to sit by it. So two places in particular, on the Hudson River, of course, both Yonkers, Poughkeepsie, and Hudson, always familiar to me. But I also lived on the Delaware River for a while in Milford, Pennsylvania, which is the top of the Delaware water gap. And I want to retire there. That's a place where I put my feet in the Delaware, which is kind of a dangerous river. That is where I feel like some kind of legacy, some kind of land keeper connection. There's something about the earth there. That's a Wyoming trail. It's a 209 is a Native American, the Minisink Trail, Native American, a lot of history along there. It's just a beautiful waterway. It starts up in Cooperstown, which I'm a baseball fanatic, so that's the headwaters of the Delaware up there. And it goes all the way, as you know, to Philadelphia. So it's a beautiful river, and there's something about just that area around it, the woods, the water, the way things grow there, the wildlife. Just made me feel the second I stumbled onto it, and I got there because my daughter got recruited to play ball at East Stroudsburg University out of Poughkeepsie. And so I moved there when she went to school there because I found out tuition was half price if you were a resident. And so as soon as I saw it, I said, I think this is where I want to stay. I moved back out of there, much to my chagrin, about 10 years ago, and I cannot wait to get back to that area. Even though Hudson is gorgeous, I think that's where I want to go.
Can you tell me more about what you like about it?
So, anything by a river, I love if I could be anything in nature, I would choose to be a river because it's so nurturing, because it's constantly changing, because it's always moving in some direction, you know, things like that. It carries so much with it. I'm fascinated by them. Both the Hudson and the Delaware River valleys are, they're so seasonal, they're so, but the Hudson being estuarial is just a breadbasket for all kinds of nature. To me, is just an extraordinary example of how nature can work in symbiosis and so many different species coming together along it. I mean, the Sargasso Sea eels that have come all the way up and, you know, I've done some work with the Native American stuff around here. So the Hudson River is called the Mohicanituck, which means the river that flows both ways. And Moanawasik, which is where the Wappingers Creek comes through, is all old Native territory. Where I live in Fishkill, not far from my little condo where I stay now, is the Daniel Nimham, who was a patriot of the Revolution, was there. They had an encampment where the Fishkill Creek bends, and Mattawan is trout stream. Wan is slow flowing water, so Fishkill is just named for that. And so, you know, the history, the diversity of the people there now is kind of interesting to me. I don't find so much of that in Milford, Pennsylvania, which is a little bit of a stretch for me, but really, I've worked with people for the last 60 years. I'm about done. I wouldn't mind having a little cottage out in the woods somewhere and working with dirt, because to me, the land is really the most important thing, the land and the water. People come and go. The land and the water will always be here. So I'm about ready to just spend time sitting on my porch in the morning, watching the sunrise, digging in the dirt, maybe not seeing people for weeks at a time. I love the people I've worked with, but it would be okay to have some quiet time as well. They're all beautiful areas, you know, the snow in the winter makes them so clean and precious with the crystally look. And then the summer, you know, when spring comes, it's just the smell of the dirt, you know, the life rising from it, the summertime, the dog days of August, which I had my son on July 25th, and whew, boy, I couldn't wait to have him. but the change into fall when the colors come, and it's just so extraordinary. I have not traveled much, you know, sadly so. Just always seem to have too many requirements and responsibilities, but I don't think I could find a place more beautiful than the Hudson Valley in the fall. Years ago, I used to motorcycle ride through it, and you're just coming down to like a crayon box of just extraordinary colors and smells. I worked in prison for a long time, and one of the things I used to do pretty much every fall was sneak in a bag of autumn leaves so the guys could stick their noses in it and get that smell again, because there's no trees around prisons for security reasons. So they miss all that. You know, it's always seen at a distance, and you miss the smell. So the sensory explosion of living in a place near water that's so seasonal, like, you know, like this is, to me, is, you know, can't be missed. It's beautiful. I see those calendars with the Mediterranean and everything, and I think, yeah, we got it. We got it going on here. So, okay. So, yeah, home. I mean, home is where your head is, right? Yeah. But it's a peaceful place. It can be a peaceful place.
Spoken about your connection to nature. Can you tell me more about that?
So I was fortunate in that I grew up in a family where we were allowed to spend a lot of time out of doors. Like I said, there was a meadow and the river right across the street from us. So not like now where parents are so frightened for their kids. You know, we, like most people my age, would go out in the morning, get on our bikes, and not be seen again till dark. So that was great. And my parents, my father in particular, I shouldn't say that. Both my parents were big gardeners. My mother had an extensive flower garden. My father grew vegetables every year that kept us all eating healthy and that we really enjoyed. And I think he enjoyed the coming home from work every night and working in the garden. And that's what I remember, is him out there getting his back sunburned, listening to baseball, drinking Ballantine, and tending the garden. So it's that being outside and that working with nature to meet our needs without being harmful to it, you know, taking only what we need and no more, being thankful for that, which is really important to me. I think, just, you know, from an early age on, appreciated the colors and the smells and the textures and learning about the different plants. And that swampy meadow across the street from us where the skunk cabbage would come up every year, which was not much joy in that. But then in the wintertime, it would flood out and freeze over, and we could ice skate for free. So that was even better. So, yeah, so from an early age, I love that. I live in a condo now with just a little patch out front, but I still keep a small garden. I have two daughters, they're both phenomenal gardeners, really into it. So, you know, they keep healthy food supplies for their families, as well as the beauty of the flowers. Like Ralph Waldo Emerson said, the earth sings in flowers. So I often think when I step outside and see some beautiful conglomeration of even wildflowers, you know, it's just, there's another tune I can tap into. So, you know, I think now, like this recent storm that we just had, Mother Nature may be spanking us back for not appreciating all the things that have been put here for us, for trying to use them up too fast. I read a book, a couple of books by this guy, Kent Nerburn, about Native American philosophy, and one of the things this old native had said was, people make fun of the Indians because we were too stupid to invent the wheel, right? But he said, But think about it. I mean, everything we do is in circular shape because of the hoop, the sacred hoop. So it's not that we didn't invent it. Think what the wheel has brought. It tears up the land, and it allows us to bring much more than we ever need. So the waste and the misuse of resources pretty much tied to that concept. So I read that years ago, and it's always made me think about, you know, how can how can we think through to these things that look at the moment so, what's the word, facile or helpful, an easy way out. And in the prison work that I do, that's one of the things that we discuss the most, is how the shortcut usually turns out to be the longest way around, painfully so. What looked like an easy get turns out to have caused much more harm than good. So it's made me much more deliberative than impulsive, which is probably more my nature, and able to, not always successfully, but able to kind of question the things that I'm involved in and the things that other people are creating to think, well, where's that going to take us? This whole thing with the internet and things like that, that so many people are like, oh, this is genius. And how do we keep that focused on the positive stuff without the drain that often comes with it? So that's kind of been a concern for me and comes out of my relationship to nature, which is so time sensitive, and so patterned, but without that kind of rigidity that doesn't, leave it this ability to constantly evolve. So I think that's so fascinating to me, is how that keeps moving forward, sometimes imperceptibly, but always with a better, I don't like that word better, always with a different or maybe more functional purpose in mind. And I think if we could take a lesson from that, it would make our lives simpler and more functional as well. Yeah. I'm sure all that stuff was put here for a reason, right? Yeah. Okay. So, yeah, nature, big, wish I could spend more time out there, and I think I probably will. Finally coming down to the end of all those, doing a lot of chaotic years, and then there were a lot of responsible years, and now I think I might find that happy medium in between. Yeah, good stuff. So,
would you like to share anything about the chaotic or responsible years?
Okay. So, like I said, I grew up in Yonkers in an alcoholic family. So I had three older sisters, and my parents, by the time I came along, were both pretty heavy daily drinkers, even though they were wonderful people, went to church and things like that. But there's a level of chaos that's associated with a family that remarkably had the routine of drinking every night at the same time. But that also meant that you really couldn't be so sure about what would happen next. So I think, my parents, like I said, were lovely people. But by the time they had my sister and I, they really didn't want any more children. I was born when my mother was 40. I think I was a surprise, certainly a mistake as she described it to me. But it meant that I didn't get a lot of supervision as a kid. So I pretty much went out on my own as often as possible and started running away when I was like 13 or 14. And it was interesting because there were two different responses to that. My mother would call the police and try and file a PINS petition, and my father would maybe like take me to a Yankee game. And so not real clear direction in that regard. And then there were a couple of years when they sent me to live with my sister for a while. That didn't pan out too well. She was having her own issues. And then I came back and I got involved in some good and some negative stuff. That was late 60s, early 70s. The war was on, a lot of drugs. I actually got heavily involved in the church for a while, and somewhat involved with the Black Panthers with their breakfast program, which was a wonderful thing. My dad was actually very involved in the Episcopal Church, so they, St. John the Divine Cathedral in New York City, did a lot of sponsorship of the Black Panther movement and the breakfast programs and things like that, and had actually, they were rebuilding that church, and then they had stopped for a while and said, we're in the middle of all this poverty in Harlem. We can't be spending all this money just to make the front of the church look good. But then the church looked terrible still, so they said, well, is there a way that we can combine our needs and the needs of the community? And so they brought in stonemasons to teach local kids how to do stone carving so that they would have careers and opportunities for them and the church would end up looking good. So, yeah, I thought that was pretty remarkable. But at any rate, so I got involved with some of that. I applied for a bunch of college scholarships. I did really well and remarkably, I don't know how, in high school. I didn't even finish. I left in the middle of my senior year. I had plenty of credits. I was already graduating. The school was a disaster. It was kind of a ghetto school. There was a lot of drugs and fighting and guns and things like that. So I got out and went to work. And then I got into college, a local college that I went to. And then while I was working, I had met somebody who was also going to college. And like an idiot, I married him after my first year of college, quit college, gave up all my scholarships, and said I would go to work to put him through graduate school. And we got married in my parents' house, and then my father died shortly after that. And then the chaos kind of began. He was abusive for a while. I started drinking. Yeah, things started to really disintegrate. Not long after that, I had a baby a few years after that, and I had put him through graduate school. We found him a job. He started making really good money, and I worked for him a lot, not for much pay or any sometimes. And finally, I said, you know, enough. I want to go back to school. And he was like, ah, no, I don't think so. So that ended in an ugly divorce. he left when our daughter was four. And we had agreed, you know, you could have this and this, and I'll keep this and this. And we had bought the house that we lived in. My mother had passed by then, and there was a little bit of money, and we had bought the house with that. And so he said, well, you take the house and a little bit of child support. And then when I took my daughter away for the weekend, when I came home, almost everything was gone. She's like, Mom, we were robbed. I said, no, I don't think so. I think your father's gone. So that was kind of a mess. But, you know, the main thing was that she was okay and fairly well taken care of. But I went through like 5 or 6 more years of real chaos. I was drinking and drugging quite a bit. I did go back to school. I found out you could pay for 12 credits and take as many as you wanted. So I was taking like 19, 20, 21 credits a semester. I was dragging the kid with me to class a lot. My teachers, some of them loved it, and some of them were like, you cannot do this. Cannot have her crunching on chips in my law class. But I went to Pace University and graduated magna cum laude from there, and met a professor of law that I ended up marrying. He was an older guy. He had quite a cocaine problem. He had 3 older kids by his first marriage. I'm not really sure why I married him. Everybody in my family said it seemed like it would be a good idea to marry a successful attorney. He was a brilliant man. I'll give him that. He was a brilliant man. But he had a drug problem that killed him. I had 2 more children with him, my son and my little one. She was now 30-something. but that got abusive too, and I got clean. I was really falling apart, and my kids were not well taken care of, and my house was a mess, and everything was a disaster. My sister's husband, who was a federal agent, came to the house one day, and I mean, the baby wasn't fed, the place was a disaster, I was high. By that time I was cocaine, alcohol, and had gone back to heroin. He just picked everything up, flushed it, and threw some clean clothes in a grocery bag and took me to a rehab and opened the door and said, do whatever you want with her, she's got insurance. And so I got clean. I got clean, but I was still married to a guy who was using. So I went to a rehab. From there, I went to a mental hospital. I was there for quite some time, maybe 4 or 5 months, I think, altogether. My sisters took care of my kids, God bless them. And then I came home, and all the same chaos was still there with him. So I went through like another year or two of that, sleeping on the couch in my own home. And finally, he got really, really ill, and his law partners said, we know how hard this has been and that you want out of this relationship. So while he's in the hospital, put all his stuff out front in his car, and we'll come get it. And I was like, wow, these are really understanding people. This could save my life, because it was really hard for me to stay clean and do the things I needed to do in that environment. And there's just so much antipathy in the house. It was really hard on the kids. So I did that. And we struggled for a while, but things got better and things got crazy again. I mean, I've stayed clean now. I've been clean for 30 years. So that was 1987, and I haven't used since then. I went to AA, got very involved, did all the things I think I needed to do to stay in recovery, but it was no easy path, you know. My son ended up wanting to go live with his father for a while. He did that. That turned into a disaster. We got into a legal battle. I mean, it was just one crazy thing after another. But we got through it. And my oldest daughter, who had gotten the worst of it, the kids often went to my best friends down the street to be babysat for while I went to school or AA or when I was, you know, all through those years. It turns out her husband was molesting my two oldest. And when my daughter was in high school, she thought she saw a sign that it was happening to her brother. So she went to her high school guy, and she had never said anything, never said a word. And this was still my best friend, who often helped me out with things and stuff like that, and vice versa, and said, this is what happened. So at the time, I was working at Greenhaven Prison, and they called me there, and they said, you got to come home right now. We're taking your children. And I'm like, what is going on? And they're like, yeah, you know. I'm like, what happened? I don't understand. And so they called me into Child Protective, and they said, you know, we know that you know this and you're letting it happen. And I was like, hysterical. I don't understand what you're talking about. And then they told me what had happened to my kids, and that they were picking the guy up that day when he came home from work, that I was not to say anything, that they already had the children. So this like whole thing unfolded, and so I said, but this is my best friend, she would never let this happen there. And they said, watch, she'll call you tonight and pump you for information. Damn, if they weren't right about that. It was horrible. I mean, we had been so close. And so at any rate, that started that whole process, which took years. And this was before the Sex Offender Registration Act, and so people like him didn't get much. The judge wanted to give him weekends in jail, and I got ballistic in court, and he said, I'll find you in contempt. And I just looked around the court and said, who's in contempt here? How could you even say this? So they took us in chambers, and they struck a deal, and he got like 6 months in county jail because they didn't want him to lose his business. He was a businessman, so whatever. But the deal was that he would pay for any therapy my kids needed. Oh, great. So, but they kept their house, which was two doors down from mine. So this house that I had bought when my parents died when I was 23, I said to the district attorney, can you make them move so that I can stay there? Because I can't put my kids out to wait for the bus, and this guy in 6 months will be going back to work down this street. And they said, no, we can't do anything like that. So I ended up, I had met somebody at Greenhaven, a deputy superintendent there, and we were together now, and he said, you know what, you got to sell that house. You got to sell it. You got to get out of there. So, you know, life was kind of crazy at that point, and we ended up selling that house, and he ended up pocketing all the money and buying a much bigger house, and then he screwed things up a few years later, because he turned about 8 years later. Turned out he had a pretty big alcohol problem, and then he was forced to retire at 55, and then we lost that house. So by that time, my two older kids were gone. I moved into a... am I doing okay on time? Moved into a little ghetto condo in Poughkeepsie. Not a month after we move in, middle of the night, somebody comes in, wakes up my daughter with a knife to her throat. He had a mask on, and he said, don't scream or I'll kill you. And then he said it again, and she said, she woke up out of a dead sleep and said, I know your voice, and pushed him away, and he ran out of the house. So it was a kid from her high school. But they said, oh, voice identification is not enough. His parents swear he was home. So nothing ever came of that, except that she was like traumatized for 6 months and didn't sleep. So that was all the chaos of my kids growing up. She's healthy now and came through all that. But my oldest daughter, who had quit school at 16, was using a lot of drugs, went through a lot of trauma. you know, I mean, for the first 10 years of her life, I was an addict. And then for the next 8 years, I was pretty helpless, I think, for her. I had put her in some hospitals and everything. That didn't work. She now has 2 master's degrees and 2 children and teaches in the city and is doing beautifully for herself. So, yeah. So coming through all that, very difficult for her. I mean, my son is doing great. He went through his times, a lot of anger in him. Got arrested, spent some time in juvenile. Kept getting in trouble with drugs and stuff, drugs and alcohol. So, you know, as much as you can say to them, you know, look at what I did, that doesn't really help. But now he's got a wonderful girlfriend. She has a little boy that he's wonderful with, and they just bought a house. So he's working his keister off, and that's doing well. And my little one, who's been the rock all along, but who says, you know, it's hard for her sometimes to say her true feelings because she learned to keep a lid on that because nobody else could handle things, right? So, but she's doing real well, and she lives down. She's the one that lives in Pennsylvania. So, and she played sports. All my kids are athletic, but she played sports and was committed to them all through school. And she says that's probably what saved her. It taught her how to work with men in a healthy way because her father was not around. Her father died. The younger one's father died when they were like 11 and 9, something like that. He just couldn't keep going at his weight and with all the drugs. So, yeah, so she still plays rec ball, but yeah, that's how she got through college and everything. And she works with disabled people now, so, you know, sweet kids. So that piece has turned out pretty well for all of us, and that's such a relief for me because you think, you know, some people do everything right and still nothing happens, and I did almost everything wrong, and I can't believe how great this turned out. I mean, they're all healthy, smart, wonderful people. So I think, you know, now when I retire, it'll be just fun to have the kids come over and make cookies and do stuff like that I used to make fun of years ago. And now I think, oh my God, I remember when I was young, my mother used to watch that show, The Waltons. And I used to rag on her how goofy that was. Now it's like, oh, I would buy that series if I could, because it's just like, that is what I think is so important, is that sense of community, that sense of resourcefulness, that sense of whatever comes, we'll stand together, we'll handle it. I don't find that too much in this world. So through all this, I had started working as a tutor in Green Haven Prison back in 1990. Through Dutchess Community College, and then I became the college coordinator, and I really loved the prison work. I'm not sure why. I was always interested in criminal behavior and not much for rules myself, so, you know, but I am for treating people with respect. So I found a hunger there that I find few other places. So I started in the academic world there, and then I took the counseling exam and became a counselor. So I worked for many years at Green Haven and then a little time at Sullivan, which has high-profile inmates and developmentally disabled inmates and blind and deaf inmates. So that was an interesting population to work with. And then I worked at Fishkill Prison. And interestingly, I was joking around saying, like on Mother's Day, the first 3 texts I got were from guys who did time for murder. So... Oh, still people that I stay in contact with, who I respect, who, you know, I'm good friends with. One guy who did, I think, 33 years, and he was not the shooter. He was just out with a group of guys. He didn't even know that they were gonna do. At any rate, every morning he texts a positive text out to a whole bunch of us. And it just reminds me of the way he would always start his day with something positive while he was inside, and he has kept that. As a reminder, I think, of all the good that can be accomplished regardless of the environment. And that has been an inspiration to me. I think prisoners are some of the most resourceful people you'll ever meet. I mean, they waste nothing. Everything gets turned to something of use. I mean, think about living 25 years in a 6x8 space with such a limitation on what you can have. So, you know, sharing things, sharing skills, knowledge, information, actual material goods, all that kind of stuff, you know, not wasting anything, you know, toilet paper, paper towel roll turns into the holder for your paintbrushes and stuff like that. So, you know, I think that I learned a lot from that experience and from those good people. And today I went and became a drug counselor for a while after I left prison. And then now I do the reentry work. And so I do a lot of classes in the county jail, which is shorter term people, which is a little more difficult because I think when you go to prison, after a couple of years, you're going to start thinking about where you are and what you've been doing and really giving some consideration to the way your life is moving. And hopefully you'll meet people who have done that already and have decided what possible good they can do with their time and effort. And so the mentoring that happens, in, especially in a maximum security prison where you have a lot of guys who've been there for a long time, not that I endorse that as a way to treat people, but it just happens like that, is really positive. It doesn't happen in jail much because most of those people are in and out, or they're... Most of the people in jail are charged and not convicted, so a tremendous amount of their thinking goes to what's going to happen next. I'm kind of dangling. So it's a tough place to be. We do try and bring in life skills classes, anger management. We're trying to get a trauma-based parenting program in there now. So, I mean, a lot of this is adverse childhood experiences that keep coming back and rolling up in a new way. So we want people to become aware of how their thinking is so that they can choose to change it. And maybe see the benefit, that kind of outcome-based thinking that I was saying. That, you know, so often when we're in that survival mode, there is no outcome-based thinking. It's just, how am I going to get through this? How am I going to get through this? So if you're treading water all the time, there's not much energy to think ahead. And that, I think, is an issue that a lot of people don't recognize with people who are in situations of poverty or there's, you know, persistent illness or addiction in the household. It sucks up all your energy. So I think, you know, it's been really rewarding for me to work with that, having been there a little bit myself, and then recognizing by the good fortune of some of the friendships that I've made over the years, how incredibly productive those changes can be. So that's been a good feel for me to hang on to this world, you know. I mean, I don't know about anybody else, but some days you just see so much darkness, you think, Oh, Mother Earth, what have we done? You know, are we just putting garbage on it and using things up without thought? And I don't know, there's a lot of meanness, it seems, now. But I'm just trying to stay focused on the light. To say, you know, let's move away from that and let's try and be... I try not to say negative things politically, which is easy to fall into that trap now. But to say, you know, how could we conduct ourselves in a way that moves us towards where we all want to be? I say this often to the guys in jail and in prison. At the end of the day, don't we all just want to put our kids to bed safe and well-fed and loved? And everybody always nods. So I said, so where's our differences then, you know? It just, I find that so painful that we so often focus on those little differences and forget about the really big picture. So... yeah, so I don't know. I don't know where life's going to take me next. I sure would like to travel. I would like to just mosey across America. You know, some places I would like to see, Grand Canyon and places like that. You know, all the natural wonders that are out there. Some historical places that I would like. Run the battlefield at Gettysburg. I would like to put tobacco down at Wounded Knee, places like that. I'd like to see Alaska before it disappears. So, you know, I think that's my next plan, is be a little me-centric and take some time. And the guy I live with now, I met on a blind date. Another person from corrections fixed us up. He's a retired corrections officer. Well, he's retired now. We've been living together for about 10 years now, so he's just a good person. Total opposite of me politically, so so it's different. It's a little hard because I volunteer with a program called Alternatives to Violence Project, which was actually devised in Greenhaven Prison back in the 70s as an answer to the guys were saying, we only know one way to resolve conflicts with a hammer. We want to learn something different. And out of that has come this international program, which I actually went to Costa Rica about 6 years ago and did some work in a prison down there with it. The woman that I run reentry with is very, very involved in it. So I just started in the Connecticut prisons to do it there. But we want to do it here in the community as well, because conflict is a part of life. And out of conflict should come growth, right? We don't want to see conflict as always so negative. Can we agree to disagree agreeably and learn from each other, right? And that's kind of the goal for me of that. And I have learned so much and been exposed to so many good ideas through that, of ways of coming together and approaching problems differently, using humor, being willing to sacrifice for the greater good. These are guidelines that they use in Alternatives to Violence, which is really a heartening. I've done a million programs in my years in jail. A lot of them are really good. This is one that's not copyrighted or anything. It's all free. It's all volunteers. And when people become involved in it, it creates that safe space for them to begin to examine who they are and find out, again, the big picture. We really are more alike than we are different. So, yeah. So a lot of good stuff. I've had a lot of good experiences in that regard. The tough times were character building. I don't know. I'm not so sure about that. You know, I wouldn't trade them. I'm sorry about a lot of the, you know, situations that I allowed myself to get into, but I do think I learned from a lot of my mistakes. I'm so grateful for my recovery. I thought my kids had forgotten all about it because it was so long ago, and this past year was my 30th anniversary of sobriety, and they surprised me by sending me to a farm in Vermont for the weekend with my partner, and they said, you know, you always told us about how you spent time on your cousin's farm as a kid, which I did, and how enjoyable it was. So we thought you'd love to see cows and chickens. So there you go. Take some books and go enjoy. And that was wonderful. It was so thoughtful of them. And then recently I had three sisters growing up. Two of them have already died. My oldest sister lives out in Michigan, and I go visit her every year. But she was really sick. I usually go in August when the swimming is good because she lives on Lake Huron. But she was really sick in April. So my kids got together and said, listen, we're paying for your airfare. Go out and see her. She needs you to be there for a week. So something, I must have done something right with them, because they are the most extraordinary kids, just wonderful human beings, and life is good. Can't complain. But yeah, so I don't know, every day's a new adventure, right? I can't wait to see what happens next. I have some interesting friends, which is always good. I have the woman that I run reentry with. She's terrific, and probably closer to her than anybody. And then I have another friend who writes books about Native American stuff, and that's where I learn a lot. I have a couple of friends that do that, and I learn a lot from them just about living in that reciprocal world, you know, where everything, the give and take of everything. I heard a lecture once about how we're so hierarchical in our Western culture, right? And that's why I don't like the word better, because he was saying, oh, that's so hierarchical. But in the sacred hoop, in that kind of circular enclosure or encompassment, is this constant, you know, evolution and revolving of things that we're all privy to if we choose to be. So I like that thought. I like the idea that, you know, it's kind of what you make it. And, you know, when the big waves come, that's it. I'm hanging on, you know, hanging on. So it's been a good ride so far. We'll see what happens next. Okay.
We have about 20 minutes left.
Wow.
Is there anything that you want to make sure that you include?
You know, most people have heard stories about, you know, the nightmares of addiction and the things that went with it. So I don't like to focus on that so much anymore. You know, the only reason I kind of keep it close to me is so that I can relate to the people who are going through it now in a non-judgmental way. Because when I think about the things that I did under the influence and the mental health issues that got me there to begin with, I think that was not my true self. You know, that was a warping that happened. And so I want to be cognizant when if I forget and I get judgmental about somebody, about like, how could they be so stupid, or oh, that was just mean, you know. But I have to remember that the prism through which we look at the world is sometimes very distorted by outside or inside influences. So especially in the reentry work, I think that's really important for us to remember. And that doesn't excuse accountability by any means, But we have to tether that to capacity in some way and help people build that capacity. Because I think a lot of us don't really know what a calm, productive, functional lifestyle feels like. You know, it's like if you ate healthy, fresh green beans every day, you'd crave them. But if you've been eating French fries all your life, yeah. So I think, you know, mentally we have the same kind of issue. I see a lot of people who couldn't just sit on two chairs like this and have a conversation without trying to stir up some trouble. Something got to give, you know, because that's just what they're used to. Or worse, and we've been tackling this at the jail a little bit, people who've been from an early age set on a couch in front of a TV and the day just goes by. And this idea that I need to be productive or I should be involved in something or I should be learning something hasn't really tapped in yet. Yeah, it's frightening. So we've been working a lot on employment issues with reentry people. And we find, you know, some of the standard difficulties, people who desperately want to go to work, but we can't get them the transportation or there's some kind of hold because of their conviction right now, which is lessening and lessening, I'm happy to say. But those kinds of external problems. But we often find people who just have no understanding of what it takes to go to work every day, no desire to be involved in it much, who quit quickly. That's really concerning. And you know, like a muscle that you have to build or, a way of looking at the world that, like I said, they've never really had that opportunity. So I have a lot of concern about that, about how easy we've made things, about the everybody gets a trophy, the, you know, what's acceptable as a report in school. I mean, I think I've read some graduate school papers that I wouldn't have turned in seventh grade. That really concerned me. Now, that's not certainly not everywhere. We run a task force from reentry every 2 months, and I just had a girl from Union College come and speak at one, a senior, and she was very articulate and did wonderful research. So that's certainly not everybody, but I do see that, you know, our standards have declined in a lot of ways. Just walking down the street with litter and things like that. I don't understand how we swung so far to being tolerant to being ridiculously tolerant. You know, how can you talk like that out in public around kids? How can you, you know, walk around with pieces of your body hanging out like that? I don't know, maybe I'm just getting old. But I just feel like that we've lost that sense of respect for ourselves and for others. On which, you know, and I'm not trying to be judgmental. I'm just trying to say, like, what builds that ability to work together, to function together in a better way. There's that word again. In a way that doesn't create so much tension. And I feel now that's all we have is tension. You know, if we could turn hate into fuel, we'd be set. And that's a scary thought. And I'm not sure why that's happening. Like, I don't know if you have any thoughts on that, but it's disturbing. And I, like everybody else, I think I have to be careful that I don't fall into it, because there's just things out there that just get such a quick rise out of us now, and I'd rather my sensitivity be in the other direction, be more to empathy without enabling. It's just a bugaboo I have. I don't enable people, because that just makes them feel less and less competent, and there's enough of us that don't feel competent already. So I have a big concern that we are honest in our dealings with people and teaching or holding to a standard in a way that results in that level of competence that makes people feel good about themselves. And I don't think there's anything wrong with, you know, putting young people into situations where they'll learn different skills, not just the one that they're interested in, like, what do you call that? Video games. Oh. So, being the anti-tech, I hate those too. So, I don't know. I mean, I think I think the way that we incarcerate people in this country is shameful, and that the more people become aware of it, the more we'll move away from it. But you can't tug out the racial issue without talking about that. And there again is that judgmental, prejudiced thinking that it comes so automatically that we're often not even aware of it. Yeah. So I think, you know, the one good thing about the massive amounts of public information out there, it might be the awareness that comes out of this. But I'm not sure, because it gets so twisted sometimes, yeah, that I don't know. I mean, I'm babbling now because I feel like this is one of those knots that everybody's trying to untangle, and I think there's a whole group of people pulling in the wrong direction on it, which is pretty frightening, because I look at my grandchildren and Carolyn, the woman that I run reentry with, we often say, we're kind of glad we're old, because I'm not so sure this is such a great time to be growing up. I look at my youngest daughter who came out of college right at the height of the recession and is drowning in student debt, you know. She just bought a house, but a tiny house. And so, you know, things, jobs and everything, the income doesn't move the way it should, things like that in America. And I hate to tie issues to money, but it does in reality. So, I mean, she's happy, and maybe that's the goal, is that we'll be happy with less now. I'm not sure. Certainly, the material things never really interested me anyway, so I'm not a comfort person. But I think, you know, this generation is going to see a lot of difficulties if they don't do things like the Parkland kids and take the bull by the horns. So the last piece that we're doing now is I just teamed up with the mental health people to do a voter registration drive. And nothing political, but just to help people say, you have a voice, use it. You know, somebody's going to be telling you what to do, as the government loves to. If you want a voice in who those people are, you have to get out and vote. And here's how you can get some information about who's running and stuff like that, and here's how you can register. And I think people have there's a mythology about once you have a conviction, you can't vote. But that's not true. Even if you're on felony probation, you can vote. If you're incarcerated with a felony or you're serving parole time with a felony, then you cannot vote. Anything else, you can vote. And like I said, most of the people in jail are charged, not convicted. So technically, if they're registered, they can vote by absentee ballot. That I'd like to see happen. Because I don't think your voter registration should be tied to your taxes. And most of those people really do want to be productive taxpaying citizens. So, yeah. I mean, I think people want to enjoy the benefits and recognize that you can't get the benefits without the input. So, yeah. So I think it's just an evening out process. But again, there's that awareness piece. So key to making those changes. Yeah. I think if we start to think about some of these problems more like public health problems, violence and addiction and things like that, and less like criminal behavior, let's just stop it by locking them up, then we might be able to make some inroads into the way that we handle this and change the fortunes of our next generation. Because this is a burden nobody can bear the way it is now. So I'm not a great believer in autocracy or oligarchy. I think we're going back to the 1890s, where a significant portion of the population will be serving a small portion of the very well-heeled population. I'm not for that, you know. I don't mind helping people out and waiting on people. I don't want to do it for a living. So, yeah, so I think we need to stand up now and just say, you know, everybody's got that little piece to carry. So, okay, good stuff. All right. I don't know what else to say about all this, you know. I'm grateful that I had a life. I know far too many people who died much too young, my parents included. My sister turned 75 tomorrow. She is by far the oldest person in our family. My mother died at 63, my father at 60, my sister's at 57 and 44. So I'm beating the odds now. I kind of had that Mickey Mantle syndrome where I thought as a kid I would never live that long. I thought I'd be dead by 30 for sure. I even went away on my 30th birthday because I didn't want my kids to find me dead in the bathroom. But I survived. Damn. Who could tell, right? So I guess there's more to do. I think that's the only conclusion I can draw from that, is that Even when I retire and ostensibly sit on my keister, I won't be just doing that. Yeah. So I like to, you know, my youngest daughter's doing her garden with all native flowers and vegetables and everything. So trying to kind of return to the stuff that's right for the locale and keep things, you know, what is it? Think globally, act locally. I love that concept because I think that's where our strength will come back, you know. My favorite saying in jail is that a chain is only as strong as its weakest link. If you're a weak link, what can you do to strengthen yourself? And that's, I think, what we can do, is think about how to make the little area where we are more amenable. So consequently, I'm always picking up litter. Possibly the only crime I think there should be capital punishment for. But, you know, the little things that we can do, they count. They count. And that's, I think, the awareness that people are coming to now. I see so many good things. Amidst all the negativity that you see on TV, if you really look around, you see so many good things. So many young kids who are so smart, so environmentally conscious, willing to do something extra, liking to be outdoors again. I think we're losing that video game super thumb attitude. A lot of parents are becoming aware of that. And parents and people are waiting later to have their kids, I think, too, which is nice in certain cohorts. So just this whole, you know, family-centric, community-centric move, it's got to help, got to help. Not that I'm for tribalism, but I do think that people being conscious of what's happening around them is really important. So, good neighbors, right? Okay.
You mentioned your wish to kind of close the chapter on part of your life where you're working with people a lot and go into
seclusion.
can you talk to us about that?
Oh gosh, I don't know if that'll really happen. I don't know. I am kind of a people person. But I'll probably stay involved somehow. The job I have now up here as director of reentry is only part-time, supposedly. It doesn't usually pan out that way, but it is. So I'm not up here every day. I actually live in Fishkill, so I'm up here maybe 3 days a week, and I stay with the lady that I run the organization with. And so I've gotten to see the community, but not as much as I'd like to. So I will probably stay either as a drug counselor or a reentry counselor, partly somewhere volunteering. I would like to stay going into the prisons and volunteering, because I think for people who are incarcerated to see the outside world without that cage in between, you know, without, I'm here 8 hours to do my job and you better behave because, you know, that kind of thing. But to see how the world could be is so important for them and important for us. I always got more than I gave, always. So, like I said, that's a hungry population. So whether it's actual, you know, counseling or literary stuff or something like that, there's an amazing desire for information in there. And ask any college professor who's gone in there to do courses, and they will tell you, I love it, because usually, you know, you'll say, oh, and then you'll have to read this, and everybody, eh. But when you say that in prison, they're like, well, do you have anything else by that author? Well, where could I get another book? Well, is there an opposing viewpoint that I could study? Yeah. So they're hungry, and when they come out, or even before they come out, they do some remarkable things. So again, you know, it's kind of that idea that regardless of your environment, if you want to do something useful, there's find a way. You know, a way will open. So, yeah, so that's great, yeah. I don't know how long I could stay away from people. We'll see. My hands will be dirty every morning, though. I can guarantee that. I love to dig in the dirt. There's nothing more pleasurable for me than putting some plants in or fooling around out there or something. Put a medicine wheel out front. Right? Yeah. And just to be able to greet the sunrise every morning and say, you know, thank you. Thank you to that, and, you know, to the dew on the grass and the birds that are singing. And, oh, gosh, it's like a festival out there, right? So So the joy of being part of that is, to me, that's never ending. That's a renewable resource. So
you mentioned your connection to Native American culture.
Yeah, I'm a great admirer of it. And so I'm not sure if I'm part woodland, like Wappinger maybe, some kind of Algonquin. I don't think I'm Iroquoian. We just started really doing a family history, so it'll be interesting to see if there's any blood or not. I don't know. But you know what? Most Native American prayers begin and end with all my relations. And so I've always felt like the bloodline isn't really the important part. It's more the attitude. So there's a lot of admirable things, again, about that sense of gratitude, that sense of everything having a purpose, not taking more than you need. I love those thoughts. And just the quiet way that people live, like, people, you know, everybody has their responsibilities and duties, but shared when needed. You know, there's not a lot of, there were no prisons when white people came to this country. You know, so to be exiled from your community was like the worst thing that could happen. And we don't have that sense of community anymore. I think we used to in some communities, and that's really eroded. I mean, communities don't really watch out for their kids the way they used to. And I think a lot of people want to go back to that and are trying to go back to that, and we'll see if it works. You know, I love the diversity of America. I think it's amazing how many opportunities we have to see things from different perspectives. But in the end, don't we all just want to put our kids to bed healthy, right? So regardless of how that happens, so I think a lot of people have, Native American stuff became very cachet for like the last 15 or 20 years, and then it started to fade again, and we'll see. But there's been a lot of mistreatment, land theft, things like Eloise Cobell, who had the longest running and most successful federal lawsuit ever, got all that money, and they won't take that money because the land still isn't theirs. So it's always been interesting to me, because that idea, you know, Native Americans don't really own land, they have the stewardship of it. And so it kind of was a really confusing situation to be in for them. And when you just think about how many things would be simpler if we, you know, lawmakers create lawbreakers. I'm my little libertarian streak that I learned from my niece in there. But that whole idea that we've given up so much control and power in our lives, I think, that we're always blaming or pointing to somebody else to take care of it. You know, why can't the government fix it? Or should the government should do this or that? Or they should, you know, that mysterious they. And I think that's something that's totally antithetical in American Native American culture. It's always us. It's us. There is no them. It's only us. And so, you know, when they got invaded, you know, that was a pretty horrifying thing to say, oh, maybe it is them. And how are we going to get out of it? And I think a lot of people in some way feel the same way now. Is instead of the government being part, like, we are the government, right? Isn't that the way it's supposed to work? But now it's an us against them type of thing much too often. So I'd like to see some of that kind of inclusiveness of Native American culture come back, so that we feel at one with the land and the water and the people and the birds and the animals, so that there's not this separation. Like, we could waste this and we can use up that. There's more of an equality of being to it, which is so important. I mean, what we keep tipping the balance. I don't know how long we think this is going to last. They say there's no more fire. There's all the ice by the polar caps is new and melting. You know, it'll melt quickly. So I can't imagine what people think will happen next. I don't know. I'm no scientist, but I'd appreciate some good news if anybody has it. Right? And I think that way that we think about, we keep putting people at the top of the hierarchy, and I think that's not where we belong, for one thing. And for the other thing, I think the hierarchical approach is just wrong. It's just counterproductive. So I'm hoping that we can move to something more inclusive. I mean, we have the technology. Bioengineering is phenomenal. Went to a lecture a couple of years ago, and the woman was saying, like, a quarter of the songbirds in Europe were dying because they're flying into the new towers, you know, skyscrapers. So they started thinking about, why do insects get caught in spider webs and not birds? Well, spider webs have ultraviolet receptors in their webbing, so that when the light hits them, birds have those receptors in their eyes. They'll see those webs, but insects don't. So they put ultraviolet filaments in the windows, and now the birds aren't flying into them. How simple was that? Learn from Mother Nature, right? I'm so impressed by that kind of stuff. Like, why don't we think like that more often, instead of how can we dig out every last vestige of coal or oil that ever existed on the planet and use it now? Leave all the lights on. So I think the more long-term sharing, I'm hoping that's the way that we're moving.
Thank you so much for sharing your story, parts of your story.